Well, I'm Rick Hogan. The show's After Hours. And if you've missed me, I've missed you. I haven't been on for a couple of weeks because of football and hockey and all that jazz, but we're back in business. Next Sunday, we have a half-hour show, so prepare yourselves for that, too. Today, I have on, and say hello, Mark Hogan.
Hi there.
And Michael Miles. Mark Hogan is my younger brother by 16 months and has a colorful history in music. Michael Miles is one of my best friends with whom many of you probably came to the shows we did a couple of years ago. Everything's a couple of years ago at the Hideout called called Panorama, and we're going to resurrect that show on March 30th, and we're going to talk about that. Mark, I got to ask you the story of being with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin somewhere and Muhammad Ali.
Oh, years ago, I worked for Jerry Weintraub, the late impresario, amazing guy, Jerry Weintraub. He also produced the Oceans 11, 12, and 13. And so I was on the road with Sinatra doing his different tours, and he was playing at the Sabre Room on the south side of Chicago. And it was Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, and they did two shows. And in between the first show, everyone would eat upstairs where there was a like a kitchen.
And you were like tending bar up there for him.
And I was tending bar and just seeing if he needed anything, because I would do stuff on the road with him, everything from cooking chicken rice soup to bartending for his guests. And during the day, I'd do production, then change into a tie and a jacket.
And you would help Frank put on his tuxedo.
That's the one time I did that. No, but I wound up at the end of the bar when Muhammad Ali came in to say hi to Sinatra and also to the rest of the guests that were there and Dean Martin. And they were at a table, but Sinatra and Muhammad Ali were at the end of the bar. And I was behind the bar. And Barbara Marx, who was Sinatra's soon-to-be wife, just fiancé, Sinatra motioned over to her and said to Muhammad Ali, that, you know, Muhammad, this is my fiancé, Barbara Marx. And Muhammad Ali nodded and then a few seconds later smiled and said, you know, Frank, you're not as dumb as you look. He's probably one of the only people that could get away with
get
that.
Get away with that, I
but
know.
The interesting thing about that show is that Muhammad Ali on the second show started to heckle Sinatra and Dean Martin, and Gene Siskel actually did a review of that show, but Sinatra looked over to Dean Martin and said, you handle him, Dean.
Michael, we never had that trouble at Panorama, did we?
We did not. No, I did have a long stint as a bartender, though, at the Marriott O'Hare Hotel, where we'd get celebrities not quite yours.
Not
you know,
that
Frank and Muhammad, they did not show up, but Evel Knievel did, and you know, I was his bartender. And
how was it?
Well, it was a. If you have a minute, I can tell you the Evel Knievel stories.
We got two hours.
Okay, so this is a singles bar. You know, so people three and four deep. There were no chairs at the bar. Great, and there were mirror balls, disco dancing, early '80s. You know, Evel Knievel's there with he's with this woman, but they weren't really talking because he didn't have too much to say. He would come in because there'd be the motorcycle show.
Sure,
so he'd come in to, he'd come in the bar, and I would say, "Listen, you're going to come to the bar. Can you tell me your real name? Because I don't want to call you Evel, if that's okay. You know, I like you know people like hearing their name. So I think I don't remember what his name was. I think it was Bob or Richard.
I don't even know.
I'm going to call him Bob, and one of your callers will correct me. I'm sure. But so now we're on a kind of a first name basis. He comes in and I said,
hey Bob.
Hey Bob, how you doing? And he had this ring, a diamond studded EK on his hand. But it's a singles bar and he's with this woman, but he's not talking to her. And so this other guy.
Is he dressed like a normal person?
Yeah, he's
in one of his outfits.
No outfit. You know, yeah. You'd never know. You'd never know that he was the Evel Knievel. And so, anyway, he, he's not talking to the woman, and this other guy comes up next to her and starts to talk to her, and she starts responding back to him, and then Evil calls me over there, and he says, "Michael, listen, man, you got to tell this guy who I am, and he's got to quit talking to my woman, or there will be big trouble." And I you know, usually I hated this job, but it was moments like this that I lived for, because sure. How else would you get inside such interpersonal drama? So I said, "Bob, I'll handle it." And I went over to the guy and I said, "Listen, but can I talk to you for a minute? You know, when this woman that you're talking to, she's actually with this other guy. And it would be a good idea if you didn't talk to her for a few minutes. But you got to promise you'll come back and talk to me, and I'll tell you the funniest thing you ever heard, you know." And he walked away, you know. And then Eva looks at me and says, "Michael," I said, "Bob, it's my bar. I take care of things here." You know? And the guy comes back and says, "So what's so funny?" I said, "Dude, you were messing with Evel Knievel and his babe, and he was about to ride his motorcycle right across your face. But thanks to me, he didn't." End.
You ever see that guy again?
No.
We got to take a break, but you're going to hear more stories like that. You're going to hear Michael play. We're going to tell you about our March 30th, the resurrection, rebirth of Panorama. And Michael and my brother are going to get to Mark is now... runs an operation called Legends in Concert, and I am fascinated with the reason that people go see people who are not actually Frank Sinatra or Lady Gaga or Dean Martin. So we'll get to that. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Early in his career, Mark Cogan, who's a graduate of Medill School of Journalism and decided that wisely that journalism may not be the best career path to follow, and I was idiotic and did, was a road manager for any number of big bands and performers. I mean, you did a bunch of bands. You did Zeppelin and Styx. And
yeah, that was all through Jerry Weintraub and Concerts West. The first tour I did was the Sinatra tour. And then they heard there was a clean-cut guy out on the road with Sinatra. So Colonel Parker asked if I would join the Elvis tour, fly with him, help set up the hotels and security for Elvis during the day, do production, Elvis ticket sales, which were always quite an experience, where we all met in one city and then took hard tickets, even though there was a Ticketron back in those days, to different cities. And the colonel would, you know, need ticket counts every day. Are we sold out? Then put the second show on, and did Zeppelin, Beach Boys, Dylan was one of my favorite tours.
You did the Rolling Thunder tour.
No, it was after the Rolling Thunder and before Bob became, at that time, a born-again Christian. It was the, we call it the Disco Bob tour, because some of the songs had a little kick to them, but that was a great tour. It was a great tour, yeah.
Did you like Elvis?
I waved at Elvis by that time. Jerry Schilling, who was part of the Memphis Mafia, always said, "One thing I regret, Mark, is not bringing you in to say hi to Elvis." And I said, "Jerry, the whole energy of being on the road with him, being able to, you know, this ticket sales and everything were so great, the energy so great that it didn't matter." And plus, I got in Dayton, Ohio. I was once and only time to do the Elvis has left the building announcement. So, and for all you people out there, trivia buffs, it's a little more than Elvis has left the building. The regular guy was from Chicago, a guy named Al Dvorak, and he did all the merchandising. He was sick that day, so they said, "Can you do this announcement?" They gave me a microphone and a little sort of script, and it was, "Elvis has left the building. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis Presley has left the building. Pause, but you can still get your Elvis super souvenirs. Ladies, your Elvis button. Turn it over, it's a compact mirror. Again, Elvis has left the building, but you can still get your Elvis super souvenirs." So that's trivia for all you Elvis fans out there.
Well, there are still a million Elvis fans out there. You now run in various places, yep, Legends in Concert, which is a collection of entertainers at the top of their field. Who are, you can't call them impersonators, right?
No, in a way, impersonator sometimes implies exaggeration more and caricature type things. So, mm-hmm. Legends in Concert was founded in 1983.
Wow.
And it started off as a six-week run, and it became so popular and so well that now, 39 years later, they're permanent locations in Myrtle Beach, Branson, Missouri, Foley, Alabama, Las Vegas, and Hawaii. And then I wind up doing limited engagements in Atlantic City, Foxwoods, where we just did a holiday show, and we've been going to Melbourne, Australia, to the Crown. So
you went to Macau.
We did Macau one time, too, which was fascinating, too.
Just yeah, and it's a gathering of, it's like an Elvis, a Lady Gaga, who knows. Mark, why do people go to these shows? I went to one when you were in Foxwoods a few years, 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
And there were 1,500 people on a regular night.
Well, the interesting thing is that, I think what's sustained and why there's so many tribute shows out now, more than ever.
No kidding.
I mean, you can go to a small city outside of a big one, and you'll find that they've got a budget to bring in a tribute artist or an Eagles cover band. And they're just all over. We just finished the Foxwoods show that had an Elvis Presley, one of the best in the world, because he was one of the winners of a contest that Elvis Presley Enterprise does every year called the Ultimate Elvis Tribute Artist Contest. And they bring people in from all of the world. And Bill Cherry was the winner of that back in 2009. He reminds me the most of being out on Elvis of all the ones I've come across. But we also had a Tina Turner and a Cher and Elton John and a Michael Jackson. But to show how sort of popular these shows have become, the Tina Turner and the Cher competed against each other on a new Ish entertainment show that's executive produced by Jimmy Fallon that was on for 10 weeks on E! Entertainment recently, and they had tribute artists and cover bands. It's fascinating in a way.
Why do people go?
I think there are two things. Music is all about the heart. And when you come to a legend show, you might, or any other tribute show, because there's some coming in here into Chicago. But for a second, the critical mind will say, that's not Elvis, or that's not Michael Jackson.
Well, the rational mind will say that's not Elvis.
But the music is the bridge. The music is the bridge. And if they sound like them, and they've got a live band, and they've got dancers, it becomes an entertainment experience, and for many it's the closest thing they can get to having seen some of these artists live.
For many, it spurs their memories of the real thing when they were there, right?
It does. In fact, when we did an Elvis tour with four Elvises and an Anne Margaret years ago, and it did really well. It always played Rosemont and would sell out.
Four Elvises, Elvis at different points
exactly.
in his career.
Exactly.
No fat.
out of shape at the most. We would do the Gold LeMay outfit Elvis, the early years, then the movie years, then the black leather
comeback
that he did for the TV special, and then finally the concert era. And we were in Shreveport, and I saw a 70-year-old woman at the other end of the aisle, a 17-year-old dancing and moving to this. And I went up to them afterwards because I was always curious, why'd you come? And the 70-year-old said, I had seen Elvis before, and this is so great because it's like seeing him again in concert. The 17-year-old said to me, my daddy played Elvis music as I was growing up, and this is like seeing him in concert. So,
wow. Yeah. Wow. Michael, what do you think of that? I mean, have you ever been to one of these shows?
No. I'm not, but I understand why it's appealing, because from the standpoint of buying a ticket, you kind of know musically what you're going to get, right?
Yeah.
Versus taking a chance on a band that you've never heard of, or spending, spending money to go to a classical concert. I mean, like, here's the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They're always trying to get an audience, get a younger audience,
sure.
and you take the baby boomers, who were a big ticket buying chunk of people, and they've got, honey, we have I'm going to spend $100 on some tickets. You know, do we want to go see the Chicago Symphony Orchestra play something that you've never heard, or do you want to go hear an Elvis impersonator?
Yeah.
Because I know you love Elvis, and you know, we used to listen to him all the time, and it, you know, it pulls at people's hearts.
Also, the funny thing that occurs to me is it also pulls in, because I've seen Legends in concert, and I've seen some of these other tribute artists, I guess is the right way to call them. And the crowd, there is a young portion, there are youngsters who are a portion of this crowd. And you think it's all, Mark, you think it's generational? You think, Michael, too, that they heard the music as kids? And
I think one of the things is radio has had a big thing. There's so many classic radio stations that are just all over playing
classic
hits,
rock.
Because sometimes the music going on now doesn't resonate with the older generations. It just doesn't. But music is all about the heart and really what you'd call a law of music resonance. If it feels right to you and makes you feel good. Legends was named by a casino head in Atlantic City the ultimate feel-good show. And I think that's the key, too, is people want to see them feel like they were at an Elvis concert, but most importantly, the music gets to their heart, makes them feel good.
Michael, when did you fall in love with music, and who?
Oh, when I was a kid, it was always in the house. You know, we sang in the car. We had a player piano. You know, that was just a part of life.
What sort of music?
Things like Shine on Harvest Moon, you know, and my father sang Ragtime Cowboy Joe, and you know, those songs, singing around the piano songs, the Sound of Music songs, show tunes, and the stuff that my parents grew up with in the 30s, the classic American stuff. And then, you know, when then along comes
Beatles.
The Beatles, right. Yeah. And we're, you know, listening to, and it's just it's such a rich time, the 1960s and 70s, with like all this amazing music that's coming out. 1971, there are all these shows about that year, about all these great albums that were released and that happened that year. Joni Mitchell's Blue and Carole King's Tapestry and Who's Next and list goes on and on and on. And so, though that era and some of those musicians, you know, with all due respect to current initiatives, there are some of that stuff that that will never be matched or certainly has not been matched to my ears, where I hear something on the radio and think, oh, I'm going to go out and buy that recording.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen
anymore. In the ways in which you buy and consume music. I mean, I was ever taken with these sort of, and you've done a wonderful job, Michael, on your recordings, is the narrative that is involved in an album or a CD. These just are not songs thrown on a CD, but now in the download era, it's you just pull things and it doesn't have that substance. Am I right?
I mean, when you think about the record stores that were in Piper's Alley,
right,
or one octave higher, and then the flip side record stores,
gramophone on Clark,
there was a whole experience of going and seeing it.
Mm-hmm. We will continue this wonderful conversation on After Hours with Michael Miles and Mark Cogan, and we'll talk to Ronnie Marmo because he's in a show here playing Lenny Bruce. Maybe not a great singer, but certainly a noted comic. We'll be back after the news. Welcome back. I am with Mark Cogan and Michael Miles. Michael is one of Chicago's treasures, playing for a long time. We're going to play some. He's got his banjo here, but we may play some music off Mississippi River Suite, which is just an astonishing piece of work. What's your website? MilesMusic.org. MilesMusic.org. I will not embarrass you listeners by spelling that for you. It's MilesMusic.com. My brother Mark does not have a CD, but he has a ton of memories and a ton of... Mark, you run shows that are booked around the world, right?
Well, Legends has shows. Right now they're gearing up to open up their show in Vegas, in Myrtle Beach, in Branson, Missouri, and also in Foley, Alabama, where there's a place called Owa, O-W-A, which is an Indian tribe.
Thing. Wow. What's their show in Vegas going to be?
Vegas, a couple of them, which is great. It's called Legendary Divas, and it's going to have a Cher. And the Cher, by the way, has a Chicago connection, a woman named Lisa McClowry, who has her own show. And plays sometimes at the Redhead Piano Bar on the side years ago. She's great. She does a rock and roll show, but she also has just become an incredible Cher. And we also have
Michael. You could be Sunny then. Maybe
that's right.
You know her. You
well,
could
that's
be
the great. The great thing about Cher and a lot of the shows, they bring up a Sunny to sing "I Got You, Babe."
Do they? Really?
Yeah,
what, from the audience.
Just
an audience
very
member.
Great. Right.
Oh, okay.
And then we also have an Adele. So Adele. It starts February 4th, so
Adele canceled her
right reschedule. But there's a legendary Legends in Concert Adele who will be performing with Cher and Celine Dion, and it's a fun show.
How do you make arrangements with the real people?
A lot of it's based on the fact that it's not saying that you're doing Adele, you're doing a tribute to Adele. You also would still wind up paying all their music rights that you would need.
Gotcha.
That's how they do it.
Gotcha.
But it's interesting how big it's gotten. There are two other shows at the Tropicana and Legends in between that. They're going to have an MJ live show, and they have a Purple Rain show with Prince. It is so pervasive, but also sort of a celebration, I really think, of the music.
Too.
It's really, people
too.
Love those songs.
And who's better than Prince and Michael Jackson?
Yeah.
Michael Miles, maybe Mark could help us get some kind of a tribute artist to be part of our March 30th resurrection of Panorama at the Hideout.
You never know.
We'll talk to you later.
I can do my Bob Dylan imitation.
Bob Dylan. Tell that quick story. I want to talk to Michael a little bit. Tell this quick story about Bob Dylan, you heard he said about you at the end of the tour.
Again, this is sort of a
Tales
mythical thing, but we had a great tour, and we became like a family. It was great. We also partied a lot throughout the tour. We finished up in Miami back in 1978, which is saying a lot of what was going on down there. And so I was with the rest of the band and the dance and the singers, and we wound up having the management rep from Weintraub's office come down and said, Mark, I don't know how to tell you, but I was just upstairs with Bob, and, you know, Bob can't figure you out. He thinks you're an enigma. And that, to me, is probably one of my greatest compliments ever. But it was based on just being at the right time when Dylan thought nobody was going to be somewhere, and I showed up. So there was some like, who's Kogan? How do I know he's always showing up when it's not supposed to? And
the world's great enigma, Bob Dylan.
Oh my God. And really, his music, you know, you put on any of his songs, you know, Girl from the North Country or any song, and it just, again, it's like he doesn't need to be on stage. He's in your heart.
Well, the funny thing about Dylan is not only his talent, but how prolific he is. Michael, do you, you know, are you stunned by that too?
Oh, I've always loved Dylan, and one of the artists who's going to be in the Panorama show, Steve Dawson, and I have done this annual tribute to him at the Hideout, for a few years. The last years we did to an empty Hideout that was streamed, but it's not like a Legends show, although it could be, you know. Because we're not trying to be him, we're just taking his magnificent work and doing our interpretations of those songs.
Pete Seeger was also a huge influence for you, was he not? I mean, a huge influence.
Well, Pete was one who encouraged me, and his encouragement changed my world, because all my efforts on the banjo were, Pete said, these things that are too inflammatorily nice for me to repeat about how much he liked what I was doing, and then we corresponded for 25 years.
Yeah.
And I gave that correspondence to the Old Town School. It's on display there. But and basically, I was one of the lucky ones in Pete's world that he did this. He took it upon himself to find people, excuse me, who were doing things that he believed in, and then encourage them to support it. You know, and it was, you know, without his encouragement, because as a working musician, not in the Legends business, but in the non-for-profit kind of folk alternative music world, you know, there's not a lot of lots of money to be made, and so you're you know, you do it for the love, not the money, and you do the best you can to survive.
But also, you have, and one of the reasons I admire you so is you have pushed your artistic talent. You have created shows. A couple of them, I was part of one, but set in a specific year. Tell Mark about these shows, will you, and how they came to be. Because they were just, I'll never forget leaving one, I don't even remember the year, 60-something, I think, and leaving the show and seeing someone I knew, and I had a very small part in the show, and her saying, oh, this is so great, when is the next one? I'm going to buy tickets for all of my friends. And I said, that was it. One night only. Tell Mark about these and the listening audience, too.
They were, I called them musical documentaries for the stage. And we took a number of, the very first one was called December 6, 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And Words and Music of an American Day. And that was looked at the entire year of 1941 up to midnight on December 6th, and with the premise that on that day, everything changed, or on the next day, everything changed after Pearl Harbor, so we looked at the music, politics, pop culture, and literature, and all the stuff. And here's, you know, Winston Churchill is telling FDR that there's a war in Europe, and that there's no such thing as isolationism, and. FDR has kind of made his decision to get involved in the war, but he's sort of dragging his feet. And thus, you know, by contrast, Europe is up in flames, but the song of the year in America is When You Wish Upon a Star.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and there's all these, and movies come out. Casablanca came out that year, and all these writers are doing some of their greatest work. And so we would include bits and pieces of that. And what happened was the very first show was sponsored by the Humanities Festival. The very first show was 6 weeks after 9/11.
Wow.
So I discovered that in Honolulu at midnight every Saturday night, everyone would stop and sing the national anthem in the bars, because, you know, Honolulu was such a military town with Pearl Harbor.
Sure,
there's so many people there. Well. So I didn't want to sing it. I just had it's a jazz band. We're gonna sell these guys. I want a slow motion version of this song that's gonna start in the middle, and it's trumpet, trombone, saxophone, piano, bass, drums playing. Then they come in with da 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 ba ba ba, you know, and playing that nice and slow like that, and everyone's emotions were raw. This is the end of the show.
Oh, yeah.
This is what we worked up to at midnight. Now it's midnight, December 6th. And and they played that piece. The entire audience stood up.
Yeah.
And they were all in tears because of 9/11. And they finished the song, and that was it. We're done. Show's over.
We got to take a break, and then we'll get to the next show you did. And the work involved in this, Mark, as you well know, is extraordinary. Extraordinary. We'll be back in a couple minutes after a couple commercials with Mark Kogan and Michael Miles. Welcome back. Michael Miles was just telling us about the stunning show he put together, America 1941. The next one was 68.
The one you were in was, we did America 1968. We also did a 1957
show.
As well. And the 1968 one, though, I remember, Rick, you had a small part, and because we couldn't set up a rehearsal, and I did this. Mark, you might appreciate this. I said, Rick, you're going to be in the audience. Your cue that you're on is the song "Yummy, Yummy, Yummy" is going to come on. It's like the original one, you know. It's going to be played, and it's going to play until you get out of your seat and get up on stage and take your position at the microphone. So the sooner you get up there, the sooner the song will stop, and you can get on with what you've. And then you played the part of Wally Phillips.
Right, 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 right. Those shows, did they ever? Did you ever say to yourself, Michael, because I may have said to you, like, you should, I know they're hard to put together and they would have been impossible to do perhaps in a long run, but you must have toyed with that, did you?
Well, you know, to have the musical talent that I wanted and the range of literature that we used precluded my being able to have enough money to rehearse everybody, you know, so we were working off music stands.
Yeah.
You know, it was not a memorized show. But it was rehearsed enough so that having those music stands there and keeping them flat so they didn't, you know, look like shields in front of the people made it such that I could have great people doing great work and say, can you be in the show? Yes. We're going to have two rehearsals and then we're going to do this. And here's your part. Go home and get acquainted with it and try, you know, we'll talk about it. But if I said you have to memorize your part, the answer would be no.
Right.
You know.
What about doing next rounds virtual so people can, you know, see it on Zoom, maybe use it for something?
Well, that's certainly possible. I mean, everybody's done plenty of Zoom.
Don't you think that is in a way altered the entertainment landscape? I mean, I have a fear about it, that a lot of people will be much more comfortable sitting at home in their underwear and their own ashtray and their own drink and their own ice, saying, look, it's cold out. Why don't we just stay here and watch whatever it is on Zoom or on some other?
It depends. I mean, I still go to movie theaters. I go.
You do all the time, yeah.
Yeah. They take safety precautions and everything, but there's something special about going to see a show at a movie. The interesting thing, though, that I would think that is that way more people can see your show, and also you can record it so that people then have it there to watch another time and everything. That's all almost historically, because you're dealing with history in every one of these shows.
But then you need good camera and good lighting and good
sponsors and good there.
Yeah.
Sponsorship, Mark. Take control of this thing. I was once part of a show called Nelson Algren Live at Steppenwolf, during which I played Studs Terkel. It was about 10, 11 years ago. And it was based on some unpublished Nelson Algren stories. And they did it one. It was one night and one night only. But it still has. There's somewhere floating around a videotape of this thing. But it was very. It was just released 10 years later because it was very hard to get rights to certain things.
Yes.
And the best part of it was not me being Studs Terkel, even though I do a pretty good Studs Terkel imitation.
Let's hear it.
It was. Michael, I'm not sure I want to talk. It's not my place to talk about this now. I want to talk to Mark Kogan. I knew his father. His father, Herman, was a dear friend.
Thank you. There
but the best part of it, and it was hard to get the rights, Willem Dafoe read a short story about a boxer that was one of the most spine-tingling things I've ever seen. And for many years, I was like, oh, my God, it's only a memory. Legends in Concert is not going to say we have Willem Dafoe reading about a boxer. So sometimes there is something to be said for a moment that does not exist anywhere. I don't think we're in that time. Almost anything. If someone wants to see Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, I'm pretty sure you could Google Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin video and get something.
Sure.
You think, Mark?
Oh, absolutely.
Could you get a Sinatra concert?
I think there are some on there, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Sure, there's things that there's it, you know, there's a whole bootleg world that's there's people uploading all kinds of stuff. I've watched a great Steve Goodman concert that's you know, from the 70s, and yep. It's really fantastic. But I think now, you know, we've had enough of Zoom, you know, where it's people are just yearning for the real thing.
Well, people need to be together. I think, I don't know if that's resonating with any of you people out there, but the whole notion of going to a movie theater, just, you know, I'm sure you're not saying, hi, can I buy you some popcorn? Why are you eating Raisinets or something? But there's that communal thing that goes on at a live performance, even at a movie theater, that I think is important to people, don't you?
Yeah, but also you've got, there's a saying, fear and it will appear. And so there's still a lot of people that are hesitant to go to movie theaters. There are a lot of people, even though it's fine. I've had nothing close to seeing anything that could be dangerous in going to see a movie. And also, certain shows, some of legend shows, they've had people that can want to sit farther apart, want to wear their mask and everything. So it's a different mindset right now. And I think until things ease up a bit, or it gets to a point where COVID is not so prominent in people's fear mind, it'll, but mostly the togetherness and everything of people seeing something together is really important.
Michael, you've performed in all manner of venues, and that as a performer, that's important to you too, is it not?
Well, there's that whole relationship with the audience that is paramount. Yeah. You know, your guest who's going to come on, who did the Lenny Bruce show, what's his name again?
Ronnie Marmo.
Ronnie, yeah. So when I saw that, it was beautiful, that theater at the
Venus Cabaret.
It's a Venus. It's nice and small, so there were maybe 30, 40 people at the most. But the relationship that he had with the audience was a part of the experience. Yeah. And so when you're on, you know, the little audibles that the audience gives to the performers, with the exception of Muhammad Ali harassing, you know, Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra.
I love that.
You know, people like those audibles sometimes. They're like, oh, that's kind of like, but that relationship and feeling like you're sharing it. I mean, one of my musical heroes is Yo-Yo Ma, who, you know, when he was interviewed about how he does the extraordinary music that he does, he says, well, I go out on stage, I have nothing to prove but something to share. And idea of that, well, and he, when he's giving, and there has to be someone to receive.
Interesting you say that because one thing that Bob Dylan, I think with an interview with Ed Bradley, said, that songs came through him. In a sense, musicians and a lot of performers are a lamp on which a light comes through them into the audience to connect with them. I mean, it's a little out there metaphysically, but it's true. It's if Bob Dylan thinks that he didn't write the songs, but something within him came through him, then that's really what Yo-Yo Ma. I saw him at when he was at Grand Park.
Oh, that was amazing.
There's such a joy that he has in what Michael just said, giving. And what he's been given, he gives out. And that's what I think all artists and performers and musicians do.
And Igor Stravinsky said that about the Rites of Spring, that he did not compose it, but rather he was the medium through which it was channeled.
You don't think there could ever be a Yo-Yo Ma tribute artist, eh? Because no one can play like him.
True.
That's right. They have to play the music. He plays the music.
Yeah.
Are there any tribute artists out there who play instruments, too?
Well, a lot of them are accomplished musicians. And that's another thing. The Erica Mahl, who won her segment of Clash of the Cover Bands as Lady Gaga, and she is
Clash of the Cover Bands?
It was on E! Entertainment.
People
can look it up.
Thing?
It was executive produced by Jimmy Fallon, but Erica's used to tour as an opening act for Dennis DeYoung when he was out on the road, too.
Sure.
So she's an accomplished pianist and plays – when she's playing a Lady Gaga song that Lady Gaga plays on a piano, she's playing it. And Elton John, same thing. And it's – and yeah, so they're
– You were on the road with Dennis and Styx. I know that.
The Kilroy.
Yeah.
Kilroy was here. So was I. But that was an interesting tour, for which
no Muhammad
I'm saving
Ali
for the
now.
Book.
Yeah, save it for your book. You should write a book. When you were out on the road, you were thinking of maybe just talking into a tape recorder every night, but you've retained all these fantastic stories. And there are some stories that we cannot tell on the
That's
air
true.
That are just a little Led Zeppelin stories that we cannot tell.
I'd like some anecdotes, dig a little deeper here.
That sound means we'll be off for a few minutes, and when we come back, we'll talk to Ronnie Marmo. We will all interview him. We will triple team Ronnie Marmo, the star of I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce, which starts up again at the Venus Cabaret Theater next weekend, and Michael can rave about the theater, and so can I, and we'll get Ronnie to invite you to the show, Mark. We'll be back.
Great.
Welcome back. I'm sitting here with my brother Mark Cogan and the great musician... producer Michael Miles, and on the phone we have the one and only Ronnie Marmo. Ronnie, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Congratulations, by the way.
Which part? My fiance or the show?
Yeah, both. But most, the most newsworthy is your fiance. Tell us what happened.
Well, you mean how it happened?
Yes.
Let's just say I did a lot of soul searching and realized I don't want to live without this woman. So let me lock it in. You know, so I'm very lucky. We actually met at the show. Funny enough,
I know you're going to be on for what? It's a great story, right? She came to town to see some friends, and her friend stood her up. And what happened?
She then Google searched best show to see in Chicago, and I'm happy to say that my show came up first. I swear I had nothing to do with that.
I know.
And she bought a ticket. It was sold out. There was one seat left, and it was front row, and she bought the ticket, came to the show, and we said hello afterwards, and everything kind of went in slow motion, and that was over 2 years ago. So
that's
wonderful.
Great. I've met Janelle a number of times, and she's a lovely, wonderful person. I am flabbergasted that she said yes to you.
Well, I'm shocked, too, believe me. I was like, I have a video, and I said, are you sure? She started hyperventilating, and then I said, do you need a doctor? I'm not kidding. I'll send you the video.
Ronnie, you're coming back.
Is this a yes? Is this a yes? You know.
You're coming back to Chicago to continue on in the hit show, I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. You start up this coming weekend, right?
Yes, sir. I'm flying back on Thursday, back on stage Friday, and I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Well,
so,
Michael Miles, who's sitting here, who never met, and you would love him, he saw the show, unprompted by me. Michael, what did you think?
Oh, I enjoyed it. I knew some of Lenny Bruce, but not the whole story, and so the portrait that you presented was so compelling and powerful, and we were talking before, the three of us, just about the relationship between the people on stage and the audience, and how vital that is. You know, you can't you could try to do that show on a Zoom thing, but it's like that interaction that you had with the audience was what brought it home, and I think that's what we're all yearning for.
Well, a great part of that.
Thank you, Michael.
And a great part of that is Ronnie and Michael, because Michael's been there and I've been there. The Venus Cabaret Theater is really one of the great rooms in Chicago, don't you think, Ronnie?
I do. I'm so excited. The Mercury Theater had this gem, you know, in the building and didn't really know. And then during the pandemic really developed this wonderful cabaret space. And, I think they're going to do a lot of producing for a long time to come in that wonderful space. And it suits Lenny so well. It feels like Lenny would have played the room, and you're going back in time, you know?
You know more about Lenny Bruce than almost anybody I know, except maybe his daughter, Kitty. How are most of the people who see your show never, some have, but most have never saw Lenny Bruce in person, and whatever they might be able to Google, and there's not that much out there, you might be able to see, you know, the Dustin Hoffman movie about him. What's been the reaction first, Ronnie Marmo, from the people who did see Lenny, and then from the people to whom Lenny is a stranger? What do they say to you, Ronnie, after they say, "Oh, I saw Lenny at the Claysters in 1957 or something"? What did they say to you?
It's so exciting, you know. That's always like my review, how I'm doing, like with the show, is like how the people who saw him, know him, love him. It's kind of like going to see your old favorite band again when they're doing all the hits. Sometimes you see people react to the bits, but you know, it's great to see people and meet people who love Lenny and had seen Lenny and know of Lenny. But what was really incredible is like when Jack Burns, the great comedian Burns and Shriver, sure. Burns and Carlin, Joanne Worley, Richard Lewis, people we know and love, you know, on a celebrity level, would come and they would cry, and Jack Burns would kiss me all over my face saying, "My friend Lenny, this Lenny, and this Lenny," you know. So then I was like, wow, okay, so I think I'm doing this right, because those guys who knew Lenny, Pat Harrington, the great Pat Harrington, all those people would come see me do it, and they would just lose it, you know. So that was wonderful, and Kitty Bruce, obviously, is my biggest reviewer, you know, what she thinks matters. And then the people who don't know Lenny, I think they're pretty taken back. I mean, some people think, you know, Mrs. Maisel, they have a Lenny Bruce character on that show, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and they think he was, you know, they come and they go, "He was a real person? I can't believe it." So it's really cool. I go, not only was he a real person, he did a lot for a lot of people, and, you know, if you like comedy and much more than just comedy, you owe a little bit of gratitude to Lenny for what he was able to do, you know?
You don't think of yourself, Ronnie, and Mark and Michael, get in on this and ask him. Ronnie's a wonderful guy and a smart thinker. It's not really an imitation of him, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, I don't know how to do imitations. You know, that's not my thing. So I didn't want to do a characterization of Lenny. So what I did was I listened to everything I could. Yeah, I get my hands on. I read everything. I watched everything. And then I kind of threw it away and just kind of found his voice as I see it. And, you know, not to get too kooky on you, but, Rick, you know this. It's like Kitty Bruce and Joe Mantegna and other people feel like there's just something bigger going on in the room. And I'm kind of, in some ways, getting to, you know, carry the torch for Lenny and, you know, represent him in a way that, if anyone ever said, do an imitation of Lenny Bruce, I'm not sure how I would do that. I don't know how to do that. But somehow the thing that I have found in my research and my heart and my soul and my approach, it somehow is exactly like Lenny. And I wanted to do well. I didn't mean to imitate him, if you know what I mean.
I do indeed.
I'm not sure what to make of that, you know?
Well, you mentioned Joe Mantegna, and Joe Mantegna, the Chicago icon, and a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful guy, too, is directing this show and has been directing it all along. Ronnie, tell the story of how, because it says a lot, it says a great deal about you, but it also says a great deal about Joe, about how that came to be.
The Lenny Bruce Show. Story of how I met Joe, first of all, is great. About 17 years ago, I wrote this script, and I had all my, you know, my schmucky friends in it. It was a film. And I was like, I have to have the actor Joe Mantegna do this one role. And I didn't know Joe. And I wrote a letter to a P.O. box. And I sent the script. I found a P.O. box for him. And I was like, you know, I'm an Italian-American actor. I admire you so much and what you've done with your career. And if you would give this kid a shot, I would be really grateful. And 2 days later, my phone rang. It was Joe, and he said, "I read your script. Let's have lunch." And so there's Joe in a nutshell.
Yeah, it really
is. But how did, you know, he's the best. He's the mensch of all menches, you know. But the Lenny Show, I had been writing, and I said to Joe one day, "Joe, I think I'm ready to, you know, show you the script. Would you take a look at it? I'd like you to direct it." And he said, "Why don't you just read it for me?" And I was like, "Okay." He's like, no, you should do that. Just read it right now." And I'm like, "Right now? I'm not ready." And so I stood up and I read the show for him, literally. And he said, "Okay, I think there's something here." And he was really instrumental in the dramaturgy of the script. He took it, like, in my opinion, the last 15 yards. Like, he was like, why don't we move this scene? He's so smart, you know?
Yeah.
Why don't we move this scene? What do you think? Why don't we start the play this way and we'll bookend it? That was Joe. And I was like, okay.
Mark, you have yet to see this, right?
No, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Mark was out on the road with managing Legends in Concert in Foxwoods. You guys will hit it off.
Yeah, too. I liked what you said, though, about imitation, because imitation sometimes come off as exaggeration rather than, in your case, you probably embody the energy, spirit, and almost the, quote, soul of Lenny Bruce that you give to the audience. Would that be?
That's how I feel about it. You know, I appreciate that. Yeah, that's how I feel about it. I think I'm just trying to do him justice and put myself where he was and work from inside out. As you know, with imitations, a lot of times as an actor, you're working from outside in, and you know the performance may fall a little flat or not have the authenticity or the truth based in something real. And with Lenny, I was like, look, if I'm going to play this man, it's got to be as honest as I can muster up. Yeah. Which is why I'm able to do it 350 times, literally.
Yeah, is it that many now? Wow. Let me, Ronnie.
Yeah, maybe 370. I don't know, but I'm constantly exploring him in the monologue as opposed to going on autopilot. You know.
Well, and you've changed. I mean, you know, while you've been doing this show, the world has gotten very touchy and increasingly politically correct. And I know that you let one. The routine of Lenny Bruce, a famous one, go. And I think that was a wise, given the tenure of these times, I think that was a very, very wise move. But there is still, Lenny Bruce was nothing if not politically incorrect. Do you get any blowback from people saying, well, you shouldn't use that word, you shouldn't say that people were, I'm not going to give away too much of the show, but do you get any of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you want to hear something kind of bananas?
Sure.
Lenny Bruce, you know, I would say, I mean, this is kind of a generalization, but I would say if I had to, like, guess, he was speaking for the brown and black people of the 50s and 60s. He was speaking for the people on the left. He was standing up for people to have an opportunity, whatever that may be, freedom of speech, all that. Do you know that today the people, so many people on the radical left are so sensitive to the whole, everything in the damn world, that the people on the right who are screaming, you know, free speech, don't take away my words, they think I'm doing the show for them. And I watched my audience shift before my eyes in the last 3 years. I literally started with one audience, and now I have a new audience. And but what's funny is the people on the left still support Lenny. But now everyone in the world thinks the play is for them, which is good. As a producer, it's good. But Lenny's rolling around in his grave going, no, I wasn't actually standing up for you. This is probably what he's thinking, you know.
Ronnie, stay on the phone for about 2 minutes, and we'll bring you back, and Mark and Michael are going to ask you a couple questions, too.
Nice.
And hug your fiancé for me, will you? We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. We have on the telephone from sunny California, Ronnie Marmo, who is coming back here Thursday, and he will be on stage at the Venus Cabaret Theater, which Michael Miles raves about, which Ronnie Marmo raves about, which I think is one of the great kind of cabaret theater spaces in the history of Chicago. My brother Mark will go there and see the show and meet Ronnie. Okay, fellas, it's yours.
I have a question, Ronnie, about in your research, what you might have found in the FBI files for the Freedom of Information Act. That's the... I'm sure there was stuff there that that the FBI had tucked away about Lenny Bruce, and curious what the files might have been.
It's been a couple of years since I've read. You know, once I wrote the script, I would say probably any kind of files like that I was looking at was over 5 years ago.
Okay.
So it's hard now to, you know, what's so funny about this play? It's like I don't remember at this point. People say, how do you differ from Lenny? How do you feel different than Lenny? And I always say, like, 5 years ago, I could have told you that. Now I have no idea. And I'm like, did I make that up, or did that happen with Lenny? So I would have to revisit those to give you a really good answer to that. But I'll just say that the FBI, I mean, the best way I could put it without any info in front of me is they just hounded this guy, you know? It's like they looked for every opportunity to make an example of him and embarrass him. And because, you know, there's always that first guy to push the envelope and make things change. And you know, they didn't like him. My understanding is the thing that was his downfall was I met with his lawyer, one of Lenny's lawyers, Marty Garbus is his name.
Sure.
And he came to the show. We met. We talked in New York. And he said it wasn't even language or foul language. Yep. It was when Lenny had made a whole – I do this in the show, but it was a bit about the Kennedy assassination and how he said Jackie Kennedy wasn't going to get help. She was running because she was scared.
Right.
And so once he brought up Jackie Kennedy – then the FBI was like, "That's it. We're gonna find every reason to bust this guy." Hmm. And so they never blamed it on that. That was nothing that was ever made public. But that's what his lawyer said. That's when they were like, "Okay, now we're gonna get this guy at all costs because you can't talk about our first lady like that." Even though he was sticking up for her and just saying, "If you're afraid, it's okay to run," you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
So
also,
I could be more specific about that, but you know,
What was your initial inspiration on wanting to do Lenny Bruce? I mean, what was the like moment that triggered the path that you took to do the show?
Because you were in another, you were in that other Lenny Bruce show, right?
Yeah, it was called Lenny's Back in Boise Pissed.
But the initial, I mean, there's something that sparks the interest of people, and it's almost like a thunderbolt of that's something that really inspires me. I'd like to do it. When was that, and how did that come about?
Well, first, what happened was I was hanging around with these guys, Jack Burns, Bobcat Goldthwait, Charlie Brill and Mitzi McCalls, and they're a comedy team. Their claim to fame is they were the opening act on the Ed Sullivan Show the night the Beatles came, and nobody was listening and all that. So they're pretty famous comics from back in, you know, Catskill Act and all that. Charlie Brill came up to me one day, and he said, "Do you know who Lenny Bruce was?" And I said, "Yeah, I know of him. I'm a little young, but of course I love Carlin and Pryor, but my mom and dad would listen to Lenny. I kind of knew who he was." He said, "You remind me of Lenny, and there's a script that was written for me. I'd like you to do it." And I was like, I don't know. So I read it, and I was like, I knew his friends were probably at that point 75 years old in L.A. And I'm like, there's no way I'm doing this play. So, you know, his friends will come. And then Charlie and I ended up making a bit of a bet. And long story short, I lost, and I did the show. And it wasn't until I started to dig deep, I said, oh, my goodness, I fell in love with Lenny. So the Thunderbolt happened as I was working on it, not the initial, should I do a Lenny Bruce show? It was kind of thrust upon me. And then the journey of like learning about him is when I fell in love with him and realized our lives are parallel in a million ways. And then once I understood that on a deeper level, that other show that I was doing, which I liked very much, I felt like was not saying everything I wanted to say. Lenny was much more gritty than what that show offered, you know?
Oh, that's great. So. Ronnie, what's your website?
It's LennyBruceOnStage.com.
LennyBruceOnStage.com. You're going to be at the Venus Cabaret Theater Friday and Saturday next weekend?
Yeah. That's right. Friday and Saturday, I'm doing two shows on Saturday. I do a matinee, too, for those folks. And then I'll be there for 2 weeks, and then I'm off to West Palm to do a week of Lenny, and then I'm coming back right to Chicago.
Fantastic.
So.
Where are you going to get married?
Oh my goodness! I don't know the answer to that.
You know, I have have one of those cards in my. I can marry people. You know
listen,
that,
Rick.
No, okay, I get it. No,
here's my boss is right here.
So Janelle,
Hello, how are you?
Congratulations, honey. I can't believe
you.
I can't believe you said yes, but you guys are a great, great, great pair, and I can get you. You can have your reception at the Billy Goat. Which is
I'm on board. That sounds great.
Which is where I met you. Can't wait to see you, Ronnie and Janelle.
Thanks,
and congratulations on everything. And my brother Mark will be coming up to see you, maybe even this weekend.
I can't wait. Nice to meet Mark. Mark and Mike, nice to meet you guys. And
you.
Rick, thank you.
You
got
take care of yourselves. Great to talk to you again.
Okay.
It's a great show. Michael says it's a great show. Mark, you'll like it too a lot. And we got a break for a commercial. When we come back, you will hear Michael Miles' music. Welcome back. I have 25 minutes or so left with my brother Mark and my friend Michael Miles. Michael and I will be doing, we will be resurrecting the Legend Now legendary panorama show that we did at the Hideout for how many times? How often did we do that? How many?
There were 10 of them.
There were 10 shows for almost a solid year. We did shows at the Hideout titled Panorama, and they were eclectic, to say the least. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, every month was a new theme.
There was a theme. We were devoted one of the most popular ones was devoted to Royko and Studs and Freedom and Juneteenth.
We did there was a Juneteenth show. Yeah. We did a Diwali show. We did. That's right, the Women Are Smarter show. There was a show about the Great American Car.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, and there was lots of, we had lots of quotes and things. As this was 2017, right after that other guy got elected, and so the country was up for grabs, and we were exploring things like Hamilton's Federalist Papers and
We will be doing that again on March 30th. I will, now that I'm back on the air, I will be here for a half hour next Sunday, but then it's mostly 2 hours throughout.
If I could mention, too, it's a benefit on March 30th at the Hideout. It's a benefit for Care for Real. Oh, Care for Real is a food pantry, and they... as the world was like falling to pieces, Care for Real was just thunderingly successful in helping people. And in the past year alone, they provided enough food to give 1.62 million meals.
Wow.
The food pantry is in Edgewater, and they've got also, they opened up because there was demand for it in Rogers Park. So people who are hungry, and there was lots of people who are out of work, people who were embarrassed by the need. But, one of the beautiful things that Care for Real does is they help maintain dignity, and they're very generous, and they've also got a food for pets. A lot of people have all they have is their little dog,
right?
And they,
right.
What are they going to do? We can't buy food for them. Well, because they get food
most
donated.
People I know would buy food for their pets before they'd buy food for themselves. I'm serious.
Well, sure, and so sure. this is, addresses that need, but. It's hugely important. They're also celebrating 50 years, 50 years in the community.
Wow.
And never has it been more important or vital. And so all the money that we make on March 30th will go to the Care for Real food pantry.
Good. So come there. I will keep telling you about it as we get closer to that date. Mikey, you want to play something people know what you sound like?
Well, I want to play a little the band. I brought my banjo here.
He has his banjo here.
And for those of you who this studio that Rick is in, we have a view down the river out to Lake Michigan. It's just spectacular. And when we got here, it was light out, and now it's dark. And so one of the things that for me, I used to be a lifeguard at Oak Street Beach.
Yes, you were.
And I wrote this piece of music called the Chicago Trilogy with three movements, blue, purple, and black, which was what I saw the sky do every single day at this hour. It goes from blue, and then it turns purple, and you can see, and then the line between the water and the sky disappears, and then it's all black. Yeah. And that's happened since we were here. So here's the Chicago Trilogy, a little bit of the purple movement that starts it, and then the blue movement.
Fantastic. Thank you. You know, one of the things that occurs to me about banjo playing is, as beautiful as the sound is, it's also almost hypnotic to watch him play. Didn't you think, Mark?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really beautiful. It's like fingers dancing. I'm serious. It really, really is. We're going to play, Michael, before we play this, we'll take a commercial break in a couple of minutes, but then we're going to play a couple selections from Mississippi River Suite, which I think is one of your grand accomplishments. Tell the story. We have a few minutes to tell the story about how this came to be.
I had a job. I spent 2 weeks in the Quad Cities. And in the Quad Cities out there along the Mississippi River, and most people in Chicago, most Chicagoans like me, our experience with the Mississippi River is driving over it.
Yep.
You drive over it, and it takes 20 seconds, and then it's over. And so, and then you're driving out to wherever, and then you come back and you drive across it again. And it's like, here's this great river that I had not ever experienced. So here I had 2 weeks in this, and I was going around at that time. I had my one man show from Senegal to Seeger that I was doing in a theater on the weekend during the days. I'd go to these schools and do assemblies. 500 kids in the morning, 500 kids in the afternoon, and it was just this wild experience. And then on Saturday morning, they had me sent to the prison.
Yeah.
To the prison, to the East Moline Correctional Center. And it's at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, and I'd never been in a prison before, fortunately, I got there, and the guard says, "Who are you?" I said, I'm Michael Miles. I'm here with my with my banjo and my guitar to play in the prison, wherever, you know. And the guy says, "Well, you got to empty your pockets to take your instruments out of the cases. You can, you know, I'll do this, and I'll drive you up there in my truck." I do this, and I walk into this room. It's like a lunch room. 250 guys, about dressed in blue, and about 80%, 90% black. And I walk in, and I'm thinking, well, and those who are looking at me are looking as like, who the hell is this? Who's this guy? And what's he gonna do? And there were a few people who were playing instruments. They had a few instruments, a drum set and a bass and a congas, and they of course had to stop, and people are staring at me, and I'm thinking, oh, well, this is your job. You get paid to read the room. Read this room, figure out what the hell to do. And I didn't start with that piece. I played some kind of rhythm and blues things on my guitar and made it pretty loud and had some call and response stuff, and people started to respond.
Pay attention, yeah.
And they were saying, so, and I, you know, after a bit, with some who were more responsive, I said, "You guys want to sing? Come on up here and sing with me." And then the guy who was playing drums before, who had to stop, he started to accompany me, and all of a sudden, it turns into this kind of Johnny Cash moment of sorts, because the room is rocking, you know, and I'm at the center of this, and I said, "Well, you know, I specialize in Bach on the banjo.
Wow.
Would you like to hear some?" And I said, yeah, let's hear. And so I played, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, and the place went dead silent. And then I left, you know, shaking in my boots, because I can't believe what just happened. And walking out of this place, here's the prison guard escorts me, and we're riding back in his truck, and this, you know, what was kind of a unnerving moment, now it's, you know, it's not even 10 o'clock, it was like 9:45. I just was there for a little short time, but I made this connection with the people who were there, and then as the guards drive me out, he said, "Look up there," because it's right on the bank. This was East Moline Correctional Center, right on the banks of the Mississippi River, and there's four or five bald eagles flying over the river, And I had, you know, I had never been in a prison, and I had never in my life seen a bald eagle before. And that was the beginnings of this, which yeah. became the Mississippi River Suite, which was taking the Mississippi River and as a metaphorical divide of the nation. And we are split. And it started, I write a lot of instrumental stuff, but this was all poetry.
Yeah.
And the poems are performed by this woman, Zara Glenda Baker.
A wonderful woman.
A fantastic, an old friend of mine from the 1980s on, and we've done a number of shows together and things together, and she just has one of the most compelling voices you will ever hear. Yes,
I have been fortunate and honored to be in a show with her. We'll take a little commercial break. I'll play you a couple pieces from this, and we got one more story from Mark Hogan about something or other. As promised, you will hear a short cut from Michael Miles's Mississippi River Suite that you can order from milesmusic.org or any other reputable sort of CD site. Before we hear that, I want Mark Hogan to tell you the story of his it's one of the strangest stories in the history of rock and roll. You were waiting for Frank Sinatra to arrive at Alpine Valley.
Well, I got a call in the morning at Alpine Valley. It was for a rehearsal night for Sinatra. And someone from our Concerts West company called and said, Mark, Elvis has died. And can you tell Mr. Sinatra? And
this is pre-cell phone.
Pre-cell phone, just
computers.
Computers, instant news. And so he was coming into Billy Mitchell Airfield on one of the private jets that he was able to get. Either Harrah's or other casino. It was a G2 and landed at Billy Mitchell Airfield. We had a police escort, two police squads, and then a limousine. When he came off the plane, I didn't have a chance to tell him, but I was in the back police car. When we arrived at the backstage, I got out of the police car.
At Alpine Valley
and said, Mr. Sinatra, I'm sorry to have to tell you, but Elvis Presley has died. And he started this look on his face. I know no one had told him, but it's almost an interesting thing when you hear of an icon and somebody that big and that
legendary.
These are
arguably literally the two of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
At that time.
I knew that no one had told him, but I also, you sense your own mortality when you are own, when we hear that. But for Sinatra, a legend himself, to hear that was quite something to see on his face and the sadness. He went in, called his office, and found out more about it because we really didn't, at that point, didn't know.
Because you had been with Elvis not long before that, right?
Before that, we were, in fact, the last show he did was in Indianapolis, if I remember, at Market Square Arena. And we had put tickets on sale for his other shows. And so the thing that I just remember is the next night Sinatra did perform, and he held up a glass of wine and said, I'd like to make a toast. He goes, I may be the chairman of the board, but the king is dead. And he held up the glass. Oh. And but that was
something of a footnote in the history of modern music, I think. I mean, it was, you know, when you said, told me before in the story that he went backstage and he was on the phone for a while, and for a long time, and you would just like to know, there's a play in there somewhere. Who was Frank calling? And
probably first his office and his secretary for years in the office, Dorothy. And probably he was able, no doubt, to get more information than that was out there.
Sure, sure.
And, there were still rumors at that point, if everyone remembers, of what he could have died from, and theories, and goofy theories that he was still alive and this was all fake.
Well, there's still goofy theories that he's still alive, for goodness sake. That's really a story of... You ever heard that, Michael?
No. Powerful.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, we've talked about the power of music, that music, since it does go to your heart, that legends never die. Legends never die.
Wow. Yeah. That's an interesting Wow. Michael, tell me a little more about Mississippi River Sweetheart. Zara, how did you get Zara and select Zara Glenda Baker to be part of this with you?
Well, we're neighbors and friends, and I never heard myself as the speaker in these poems that I wrote. It was going to be somebody else, and I invited her to come up. I said, I've done these works, and what I'd like to do is I'm going to, if you could read them, I'm going to kind of improvise musically underneath your playing, your reading, and we'll see if the energy of what you're saying can be fed by the music that I'm going to play, and vice versa, that what you're going to say is going to feed what I play. And and within minutes, literally, it was like no question. These were hers to do, and no one else. Her partner Shanta told me the story about she said that's what Duke Ellington would say about Ella Fitzgerald. He'd write a song, she would sing it, and it wasn't his song anymore. It was hers.
You have introduced me, Michael Miles, to so many great people. I mean, among them, and I can't wait to see Lloyd King again when we perform. And I mean, almost every show, there's someone who I meet that I am grateful for the rest of my life for you having introduced us. Again, Michael can be reached and found at milesmusic.org. Mark has no website at the moment, but he'll have one of these days. And you can buy many, many of Michael's CDs. I would recommend Mississippi River Suite if you're saving or you don't have a lot of money and you're not Jeff Bezos or something. Here to sort of end the show, and thank you to Brett, and thank you to Krista, and thank you to Jack. Here is set this up, Michael. This tune is called Land.
It's one segment of an 8-part poem called Which Side Are You On?
Okay.
And so this one is about the issue of land.
This is how we end the show. Thank you all for listening. Again, Krista, Brett, and Jack, thank you. Mark and Michael, thank you. And here is Land.
Land. What about this land? Made for you. For me. For the Cherokee. Depends on who's asking. Where you are, what you are. Child of the Ivy League. Migrant child with fatigue. By the dawn's early light, the huddled masses yearn. Will there be inclusion? There's no collusion. Can't we all have dreams here? Oh, you can't be seen here. Some are born with silver. Others get no spoon. No good water. No rainbow tune. Sanctuary. Cemetery. So who draws the laws? Who can we trust? Where will we sleep? Where's the justice? Who says yes? Who says no? Sorry, gotta take this call. Hang on, I never said that. No, no, that's not right. Remind him he owes me. Yeah, just this once. Anger salad buffet, dress blues, followed by spam. Spam for a veep and a cabinet with Soviet cigarettes, a vape cloud minuet.